The scientific method attached itself to child rearing just prior to 1900. Is the day not far off when we will view our present-day puritanical and unscientific scientific restrictions as a severe form of child abuse, worse than corporal punishment, overstrict parenting, child labor, or the Victorian suppression of natural instincts? Time, of course, will tell. Sally Fallon has written the Nourishing Traditions book of baby and child care. Not something you're going to hear from the AMA. But stay tuned. I'm Robin Clare, and this is Tributaries. Sally, thank you so much for joining us again here on Tributaries. I had to laugh when I read that your previous book, Nourishing Traditions, had launched your career in alternative medicine. You are about as traditional as it gets.
Yes, well, maybe not alternative. Maybe alternative medicine is not the right word in holistic medicine.
Yes, that's for sure. Yeah. Dr. Spock offered us, trust yourself. You know more than you think you do. And I'm not sure that's actually the main thing that he is remembered for, but I think it might be the best advice. How do you, in your new book, The Nourishing Traditions book of baby and child care, how do you get around and avoid a dogma mentality regarding child care, and especially with such an overload of misinformation for young parents, which being barraged can only make them nervous?
Well, I think in a sense I'm fairly dogmatic about certain things in the book. This baby and child care book is unique, I believe, among the books out there today in its emphasis on nutrition, and particularly in its emphasis on animal fats and high cholesterol foods for pregnant women and babies, because these are what they need for the formation of their brain and nervous system and everything in the body. So I'm pretty strong on that. It's not trust yourself. It's not do what everyone else is telling you to do. It's here's what I'm telling you to do, and I think this is, and we know that this is the right way. There's just tons of references in the book. But when it comes to some of the other aspects of child rearing, I'm definitely centrist. I hear the pull of parents who want to be very strict, and then parents who are, you know, what you might call more soft with their children. And I think there's definitely a middle ground there that depends on the parents and depends on the child. Some children need a stronger hand than other children.
Yes, well, coming from the background of knowing all about Weston A. Price's work, of which you started the foundation, you've seen what a nutrient-dense diet can do, and you actually start with this book about child care with the pre-pregnant parents, and not only the mother.
Yes, we start with both parents with a very nutrient-dense diet 6 months before pregnancy, even 2 years before pregnancy, depending on how the mother's been eating. And, you know, we hear so much about problem children, having to discipline children, children who have behavior disorders, learning disorders, and there's no question that there are different philosophies on how to deal with this, but my take on this is look at the diet first. A child who is misbehaving, who can't read, whatever, these are children, in my opinion, are suffering from brain starvation. And let's nourish them first, and many of these disciplinary problems then just clear up on their own.
I loved reading in one section you were talking about some of the older civilizations and how they would look at what children were doing and would just be overwhelmed and enjoy the joy of it all. without...
Well, there's a very strong plea in this book to let children be children, to let them play, because for the first 7 years of life, that's what children do. It's play is their work. That's what they're supposed to be doing, and it's the only time of their life when they really can engage in that imaginative play. And we recommend holding off any kind of intellectual work, any kind of school work that involves reading or, you know, learning numbers or letters. We recommend holding that off until the seventh year and just letting them get as much as they can in the way of imaginative play in their first years. It doesn't mean they can't go to nursery school and play schools and so forth, but there should not be an academic emphasis at this time. They'll catch up very quickly once they turn seven, and that's the appropriate age to start reading instruction and so forth.
Yes, it's very true, and it's being in the middle of spring right now. It reminds me of people that plant their snap peas in Colorado in February or early
right.
March, and then by
good.
April,
yes.
Everybody's got the same amount of snap peas rolling.
Yes, right. They catch up very quickly. You just don't do your children any favors by pushing them at a young age. In fact, you can create a kind of trauma, a kind of sadness in people that lasts all their life because they have been denied that first 7 years of imaginative play.
Yes. Well, I know the nutrition is your pet subject, and tell us a little bit about what are some main items that you recommend for children beginning when they are born. I know there's a lot of research going on now about vitamin K and vitamin A and of course, the importance of cod liver oil. So maybe you could share a little bit about some of these things.
Well, that diet, of course, starts before the mother conceives and for both parents and while she's pregnant and then while she is breastfeeding. And there is no question that the more she eats a nutrient-dense diet when she's breastfeeding, the healthier the baby will be, the easier the baby will gain. So that diet includes lots of eggs, butter, either raw cheese or raw milk, liver and other organ meats, cod liver oil, various types of meat and seafood. We really recommend that mothers try to eat some fish eggs like caviar or salmon eggs. Coconut oil is part of that diet, lacto-fermented foods, and of course a variety of fresh fruits and vegetables. But the real emphasis is on the nutrient-dense animal foods during this period of building the child's body. And then, of course, we recommend breastfeeding and by a mother on a healthy diet. If the mother, for whatever reason, cannot breastfeed, we provide a recipe for a homemade formula that's based on raw milk that has just been very successful with these babies. At 6 months, you start, by 6 months, anywhere between 4 and 6 months, depending on the maturity of the baby, you start solid foods. And unlike the advice that mothers are given today to start them on vegetables, we recommend starting them on egg yolk and pureed liver. These are two extremely nutrient-dense foods. They're full of choline, which is important for making connections in the brain. They provide cholesterol, of course, which is needed for the same purpose, and just the whole gamut of vitamins and minerals.
The subjects of fat and the brain are just coming out more and more and more about how important this is. And although many of our listeners I know already because they have your first book from Nourishing Traditions, the importance can't be emphasized enough.
It really can't, especially as they're getting the opposite message over and over again. Pregnant women are told, they don't need to eat a lot of meat. They shouldn't eat liver. They shouldn't eat seafood. They shouldn't drink raw milk, which, of course, is a wonderful food for pregnant mothers. All of these really important foods they're being told not to eat. And as Mary Enig predicted this, we are seeing an epidemic of learning disabilities, and that's why these children are just, their brains are not being nourished while they're growing.
What is the deal with mercury in fish? That's also in the news, of course, and is quite a quite a good topic of discussion these days.
Absolutely, and I do go into this in great detail with, once again, a lot of references. I don't think there's any baby book out there that has as many scientific references as this one does. So, yes, fish can be a source of mercury. They always have been a source of mercury. And the recommendation is to avoid fish during pregnancy, but there is a very strong school of thought that women should be eating fish. The studies show that women who do eat seafood have smarter babies. And as far as the mercury is concerned, if you're on our type of diet, the first thing that you're getting is a lot of lacto-fermented foods, which provide good flora in the intestinal tract, and that will keep the mercury from being absorbed. So that's your first line of defense. The raw milk is our best source of glutathione, and that also is a tremendous protection against mercury.
No one knows that. Everyone just goes up in alarm about the mercury.
Yes.
And there's
yes.
a good reason to. Of course, we don't want to be poisoned by a heavy metal, but at the same time, and wasn't there something about vitamin A as well helping?
Yes. Well, I'm not sure about vitamin A and mercury. I've never seen any studies on that, although it wouldn't surprise me. But vitamin A is our number one protection against DDT and dioxins and the types of...
Oh, yes, the estrogenic.
Yeah, well, and the estrogenic components as well. And, of course, our diet is extremely rich in vitamin A. Vitamin A is the key to normal fetal development. And if you don't have enough vitamin A, then, you know, you can expect some problems with that.
Yes, I know that's a large component of a prenatal multivitamin that women are given.
But usually in the prenatal vitamin, it's in the form of carotenes. And it's very, very difficult to convert those carotenes into the true vitamin A, which is what we need. And in fact, getting too many carotenes actually just makes that whole mechanism shut down. So we actually recommend against prenatal vitamins.
Yes, I knew you were going there. And which brings us to cod liver oil. It's just like superfood.
Right. And that's, we recommend 2 teaspoons of the high vitamin cod liver oil daily during pregnancy and lactation. And then as the baby is weaned, he gets a 1/2 teaspoon. And this is really critical for, you know, for them to get optimal development. And I can tell you that the babies, our babies, the Weston Price babies who have been fed this way, they're just amazing children. They are strong. They don't get cavities. They learn easily. They behave well, good musculature. They don't need braces, good eyesight. And it's just shameful that we are not teaching these things to our pregnant mothers. This is all supported by the science, but mothers are not hearing it.
Right. Well, they are now.
You've been
at this a while, and as you just mentioned, there's a whole slew, really, of Weston Price babies, as you call them. And how old are they now, the oldest ones, would you say?
Well, the oldest ones are in their teens now because
beautiful.
We've been doing this 13, 14 years. In my own family, I have 2 Weston Price grandsons, and they're just amazing children. They are fun to be around. They pick up things really quickly. They learn easily. They don't have asthma or eczema or allergies. And what we're giving them is a healthy, happy childhood, and there's no greater gift that you can give to any person.
Yes, and the parents really know that that is a main job, is nutrition, obviously.
Yes, yes.
What are you finding when you're going out? You speak internationally, I know, and I can only imagine the numbers are rising in those that come here. You speak.
The membership in the Weston A. Price Foundation is rising. It's at 16,000 members now.
Oh, lovely.
So our influence is growing. I have to kind of chuckle to myself because I see a lot of ideas. Our emphasis, for example, on cod liver oil, our emphasis on nourishing bone broth, our emphasis on butter. I see these now being repeated by lots of people, not necessarily with credit given, but that's okay. We really need to get this information out there.
Some of the suggestions, for instance, I know the Japanese have always used bone broths and chicken broths.
Right.
They
and
make
fish
them.
Broth, right.
Yeah, so they make them so they are actually distilled down into a gel.
Yes. Yes, and we this is something that's very important in our pre-pregnancy, pregnancy, and lactation diet is the nourishing bone broth. And we're learning more and more about these gelatin-rich broths, and they actually balance the amino acids in meat. And even for mental balance, these bone broths are very useful.
Is there any research study that you can mention that has perhaps come out since you have published the Nourishing Traditions book of baby and child care?
Well, I actually mentioned this in the book, but there's a very good article on our website, westonaprice.org. You know, I'd have to go and look it up, but I forget the name of it, but it's about dopamine. And dopamine is an endorphin. It's a natural hormone that we produce. It keeps us on an even keel, and you don't want too much dopamine and you don't want too little dopamine. And it's interesting that the glycine, which is in bone broth, helps keep that in balance at the right levels.
Yeah, well, once again, medicine is food. I was talking...
All these traditions about soup, about chicken soup and making you feel good and making you feel better. We're seeing the science validate this.
I was speaking with Elaine Ingham recently,
yes. Uh-huh.
And she was talking about how the nutrients are all in the soil. And, you know, with her compost teas and things like that, it just helps to make it available. So you are working with good soil. You don't really need amendments, so to speak, to bring out what you need from the soil. And the same is true with nutrition and food. It's all a pretty basic process once you get into the basics.
Yes, and certain foods are going to be much more nutrient dense than other foods, and of course those are the foods that are emphasized in the pregnancy diet. That they were emphasized among traditional cultures, and we need to copy that wisdom that traditional cultures practiced.
Now, you did write this book with Dr. Thomas Cowan.
Yes.
And he's known for his fourfold path healing. Yes, and I'm wondering what did you learn from him in writing this book?
Well, Tom brings two things to the book. First of all, the whole second half of the book is on natural treatments for childhood illnesses, measles, mumps, rashes, eczema, digestive problems. A lot of these don't tend to happen to babies who start off right, but a lot of people coming to this book, of course, are dealing with these types of illness. They might not have started off with just the right kind of diet. So that's one thing. He uses homeopathy, he uses herbs, natural treatments, and so forth. The other thing that Tom brings to this book is something that we share, and that's an interest in the philosophy of Rudolf Steiner and what he had to say about children, this whole notion that children should be left alone and allowed to play and not be tasked with intellectual knowledge during that first 7 years. That's a philosophy that we both share, and that's very strong in the book. Another thing that Tom emphasizes is the need for fever, the therapeutic uses of fever that children get when they're sick. It's very important not to suppress fever in children.
Another thing that I was reading in your book was about how when there are childhood diseases, it's a growth process that's going on.
It absolutely is a growth process. There are certain illnesses that you get at certain stages of life, and they are actually almost like a snake shedding its skin. It is definitely a child moving into a new phase. For example, measles is very common around the seventh year as the child goes from the first phase of growth, which emphasizes the physical body, to the second phase of growth, which we explain in the book, emphasizes what's called the etheric or the electronic body, the watery body, and you get a lot of watery illnesses at that time, like the measles. And so if you don't want to suppress that process, you want to let the child live through it and overcome it. Of course, you support the child when he's sick with the herbs and the homeopathic remedies and the good food. But you never want to suppress those illnesses or try to make them go away.
I have to give my son-in-law credit because that's something he brought to my attention quite a while ago with my granddaughter. And I thought, yeah, I think you're right there.
Yes, right, yeah. You know, the fever, when children have fevers, it stimulates the immune system and makes you end up with a stronger immune system. And one of the theories about why we're seeing so much cancer today is that we have spent the last 30 years suppressing fevers in our children. And they actually get over their illnesses more rapidly if you don't suppress the fever.
Mm.
Let them have a nice hot fever for a day or two. And they end up completely getting over the illness, completely immune to it, and stronger than when they started.
And you do have a place in your book where you write down, okay, here are times when you really need to do something.
Yes. I mean, if the fever reaches 104, 105, if the child is, you know, really in distress, of course, you need to do something. And we have natural ways of lowering fever. We emphasize there's certain times when you really do need to take your child to the emergency room.
Yes, emergency medicine definitely has its place in our lives.
Right.
Especially with boys, I think.
And that's the nice thing about working with Tom Cowan. He is an MD. He actually got his first medical training in an emergency room. So he knows that there's a time and place for that as well.
Yes. I think it's important to bring up some of the myths that need busting. We could go days on this one, I'm sure. But what comes to mind right now for you, Sally, that you just, you know, we brought up a little bit about the low-fat and no-fat kind of diet. That cannot be emphasized enough, but I know there are other ones as well.
Well, that's one myth that, you know, mothers should be following a low-fat, low-cholesterol diet. That has done so much harm to this generation of children. Another myth is that every woman can breastfeed successfully, and I've gotten a lot of flack for this, but it would be really amazing if the breast of all the organs in the human body was the one organ that always worked perfectly every time. And it is absolutely true. Some women will produce tons of milk, and some women can only produce a few ounces a day. And if you are one of the latter type of women, you absolutely need to supplement or your baby is going to starve.
And what do you say to that woman that doesn't have enough milk? I'm sure there's guilt and other feelings that go along with it, but I'm sure you have a good explanation.
One of the things I say in the book is to get a breast pump and pump for a couple days and see what you get, because then you know this is what you're producing, and it's not because of your technique or anything else, because the breast pump will get it all out no matter what your technique is or what the baby's sucking capacity is. And some women will pump all day and they'll get 2 or 3 ounces, and some women will get 10 ounces with every couple of hours. So there's a huge variation. And if you've pumped and see that you don't have a lot of milk, then you definitely need to supplement. We have this recipe for a whole foods baby formula that's best based on raw milk. And you can actually give it with a wonderful device called the Lactaid, where the baby, you have a little tube from a little bag of the formula, and it rests on your breast, and the baby can breastfeed and get the formula at the same time. So you can still keep breastfeeding, and the baby can get the small amount of milk that you're producing.
Wow, that's a great invention.
Right. And I've seen it with my grandchildren. My daughter works full-time, and she pumps at work, and the babies get bottles during the day, but they breastfeed morning and night. And that's another myth, that if you give a baby a bottle, it won't breastfeed anymore. We have lots of babies who do both.
Mm. Do you feel like the work you have in your book regarding Rudolf Steiner's is Has it remained pretty constant? I feel like a lot of the Waldorf schools have kind of gotten dogmatic in their approaches, and I feel like that's as dangerous as not giving the right information.
You know, funny enough, I'm not, I don't know a lot about the Waldorf schools because my children didn't go to Waldorf schools. The one thing that concerns me about the Waldorf schools is the diet. They give lots and lots of grains to the children. And I don't think that's appropriate. I think younger children, sometimes when you give them too many grains, they become intolerant of grains. And that's a sad thing to have happen. I think the children need more animal foods when they're growing and in school.
And so regarding the fermented foods, is there an age where a child is too young for that sort of thing? Or
no, you can... You know, that's one of the first foods that you can introduce. I've seen lots of babies who just love sauerkraut. It's really a funny thing to see a baby eating sauerkraut.
I know when I first tasted fermented beet juice, I thought, oh, how am I going to disguise this to give it to my granddaughter? And as it turned out, she just absolutely loved it.
Isn't that interesting? It's really fun to see them enjoy these sour foods. They have a real taste for sour foods.
Sally, is there a main question you get in your talks that parents, young parents especially, have as a concern?
I think the biggest concern that I get is from women who are advocating exclusive breastfeeding for a year. And I do not recommend that. No traditional culture does that. Of course, they do breastfeed for a long time, and that's fine. But usually around the age of 6 months, they are introducing some solid food. And usually the first food in traditional cultures is some kind of liver. Bird liver, beef liver. I know some cultures give snake liver to the babies. And I think we need to, that's a tremendous amount of wisdom there, and we need to imitate that. But I've had people get very upset with me for thinking I'm recommending solid food too early.
That seems like such a stretch, doesn't it? How did they go all the way into an animal's body and grab the liver and know that that's something you want to give your child?
Yeah, but that's what they did. That's exactly what they did. And I think by 6 months, a child has grown some teeth. They are imitating what they see around them. They want to eat, and they show an interest in it. And I think if you withhold solid food for a year, you're actually kind of holding them back. And that's not fair to the child. There's been a lot of discussion about the book. The Nourishing Our Children blog has actually done a book review, an online book club about the book, and you can see a lot of comments there, too.
I'm sure it's great discussion for young parents. I think it's bound to be the best baby shower gift if the mom has not already been exposed to it.
Well, there's definitely been a lot of controversy, but the nice thing is that we have mothers who've been doing this. We have hundreds of mothers who have raised their children this way over the past 10 years, so we definitely have some good examples of children who are raised with a nutrient-dense diet.
Has the AMA come in and said, well, we don't agree because of this, or?
Oh, no, they have not commented on the book. And the book takes a very strong stand against vaccinations. So, so we're not going to get the American Academy of Pediatrics endorsing the book anytime soon.
No Oscar soon, for child rearing.
Right, right.
Very good. Well, Sally, thank you so much. Is your next book going to be about the elderly?
Well, actually, I'm working on a book with Kayla Daniel, and it's a book on broth. I think it will be called Nourishing Broth, and it will be published by Grand Central Publishers. So that's coming out next year.
Personal freedom of choice is key in life, and when it comes to family, informed choices couldn't be more important. Many thanks to Sally Fallon for writing her book, The Nourishing Traditions Book of Baby and Child Care. Sally can be found at newtrendspublishing.com or westonaprice.org. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, and sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. On iTunes for podcasting, it's Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.